John chapter 6 this morning, we've been looking at the simplicity of the gospel, and we're going to look at a hard sermon this morning. That's the title of the message, just a hard sermon. What's interesting is for so many years as I've looked at and I've thought about John chapter 6, I thought that the hardness was because of the content. And actually, I have a different take on that as I've thought about it, and you're going to see why in a few moments. I don't believe that the hardness was because of the content as much as there was a block on the people's heart. And there was something that was keeping them from obviously receiving what he was saying. We're going to see that in a few moments here. But in John chapter 6, let's unite our hearts together if we can. I know in the summertime, there's a lot more traveling going on. It's hot. There's a lot of activities going on. And Finney said he always had more of a difficult time getting people in tune to spiritual things when there's a lot going on in the community. And so I think sometimes we have to condition our hearts to work a little bit more when we're busy at focusing. And so in John chapter 6, if we could unite our hearts together as we read the scriptures, look what the Bible says here. It says, "After these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, and a great multitude followed him because," and this is very, very important, there's two verses that are really the crux of the passage, in my opinion, the crux of the chapter. These two verses between verse number 2 and also John chapter 6 and verse number 34 that really give us insight into why the rest of the chapter plays out like it does. But notice what he says here. "And a great multitude followed him because they saw his miracles, which he did on them that were diseased." Now I want you to notice here, it says, "And Jesus went up into the mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. And the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was nigh." Now, in John chapter 5, it starts off the chapter by telling us that there was a feast of the Jews, but it doesn't tell us which one. More than likely, probably what is called the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, the Feast of Tabernacles was an interesting feast. There's another name for it, the Feast of Booths. And they were commanded to actually go and construct temporary booths and live in those. Does anybody know why that God instituted that particular feast? Does anybody know? Any of the children? Does anybody know why he gave the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Booths? It was to remind them of their journeys through the wilderness and how they were strangers in a strange land. And now they had been settled and God wanted them to remember. We are a people, as we're going to look at today, that need to remember. We have to constantly remember what God has done and what he is doing around us, even though we're very familiar with those. That's actually one of our number one steps when we coach couples, when you get to chapter 10 of our marriage book, when we talk about the second step of our two-step process, is acknowledging and appreciating the differences between you and your spouse. We take each other for granted. Now look at what, if you will, in verse number 5. "When Jesus then lifted up his eyes and saw a great company come unto him, he saith unto Philip, When shall we buy bread that these may eat?" Now notice once again, verse number 2 tells us that great multitudes were following him because of the miracles, but then you're going to see a little bit more of a specific shift here, and you're going to see a focus on the bread that he's given. This is very important, we're going to look at here in a few moments here, because Jesus doesn't go the route that we would go from here. Great multitudes following Jesus, right? Why are they following him? Because of the miracles. But then you're going to see the scriptures are going to focus on the fact that they're following him just because of the bread, just because of the physical needs are met. And once again, you're going to see the route that Jesus goes, and you're going to see the mind of Jesus. You're going to see the heart of Jesus. And we'll see that in a few moments. But notice here that he asked Philip a question for the purpose of proving Philip or the purpose of testing Philip. And he says, "When shall we buy bread that we may eat?" And this he said to prove him, for himself knew what he would do. I think there's something very interesting in this here, that Jesus here asked the question, knowing what the answer is, to prove Philip to see what's in his mind and what's in his heart. And it's not to prove to Christ, more than likely, it's to prove to Philip what was in his heart and what was in his mind. Was he going to see a bigger picture than what he simply saw in the immediate? But there's something here that I think is very intriguing here. I think one of the things that's very intriguing to me as we look at this here is that you see Jesus focus on, listen now, the matters of the heart in the people that are around him. And let's understand that if you ever pastor or preach or teach or you disciple people, let's understand that you can see people that are just mindlessly wandering through life. But notice that Jesus here doesn't just focus on on the simplistic, on the surface. Jesus is wants to prove to Philip what's going on in his mind and what's going on in his heart. Does anybody remember a few Wednesday nights ago, we looked at John chapter 4, how Jesus comes to the well, and what's the first thing he says to the woman at the well? Give me to drink. And you'll notice here that Jesus is going to instigate a conversation for the purpose of establishing a spiritual truth in this woman's life. And we talked about that a few Wednesday nights ago. But take that in consideration. Jesus comes to the woman at the well, says, give me to drink, instigates a conversation, and then Jesus says something here. Rather than just going with the flow, he wants to prove to Philip that he's seeing just the temporal and he's not seeing the bigger picture. I think there's something in this. Taking the little moments of life, instigating conversation, and getting things on a heart level, getting things on a spiritual level. The illustration I used a few Wednesday nights ago, and Brian House did validate that it was actually Woodrow Wilson that was sitting in a barber chair. And next to him, there was a pastor who was conversing with the barber. And I don't think if you know Woodrow Wilson, I don't think that it had too much of a dramatic effect on him for the rest of his life. He was an extremely liberal-minded president. But what was interesting was this, is that he says he always recalls the conversation that was going on between the pastor and the barber next to him. And that pastor was D.L. Moody. Dwight L. Moody, the great Chicago preacher from the late 1800s. And the point being is it's a little conversation like that where D.L. Moody isn't just sitting there and just going with the flow. D.L. Moody is going to do what Jesus did. He's going to get into a situation and instigate spiritual conversation, put things on a spiritual level. We have to take the oversight to do that as a body of believers. Now, we don't want to be weird about it all the time. We don't want to be speaking when we should be silent. As apples of gold in settings of silver, so are words fitly spoken. But let's understand that I think that there's something great in this. I had a guy over yesterday to buy some shelves that my wife was selling. And what was interesting is that we were talking about where he was from in the Quad City area of Illinois. And we were talking about that area because I'm from that area. Then we were talking about just the normal things he would talk about. And I was sitting there thinking, I want to get this on a spiritual plane. I want to try to move this to another level. And would you not admit that it's a little bit awkward doing that? It's a little bit risky doing that because you think, well, the person's going to blow you off. The person's not going to want to continue the conversation. And sometimes that occurs. Sometimes people stiff-arm you. But notice here, Jesus' concern is not just on just sitting there and waiting around. He wants to prove to Philip what's in his mind, what's in his heart. We have to be that kind of a people if we're going to reach people for Christ. We have to be that kind of people who take the most ordinary of situations and say, give me to drink. Or we ask a question in order to start spiritual conversation. You can be waiting to get your tires done at the shop, and you see something on the news, and you say, man, sure is a good day to be a Christian. And you'll see where somebody's at. They'll either go, oh, sure. Or you can say something like, man, that news is really bad, isn't it? But thank the Lord that we have a book that tells us what the end is like. And it's amazing what happens when we do that. Now, I love this here. He says, when shall we buy bread that we may eat? It looks like a totally innocent question, but it's a question to lead to a greater spiritual conversation. This he said to prove him, for he himself knew what he would do. Let's look at the next verse here. Philip answered him, 200 penny worth of bread is not sufficient for them that every one of them may take a little. After reading the Gospels, if you were around Jesus, would you not just be quiet all the time? Have you ever thought about that? Knowing that Jesus was the master teacher at setting out what I call a rug and basically asking a question, allowing all those around him to kind of get on the rug, and then he would just have a way of just pulling it right out to teach a spiritual truth. And I think that if I was around Jesus, I would just be quiet. There's nothing, I would just say, you know, he's setting us up some way, somehow here. Now notice this here. One of the disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, saith unto him, there's a lad here which hath 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes, but what are they among so many? Once again, one of those things that I would not say around Jesus, especially knowing the Gospels. And Jesus said, make the men sit down. Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, in number about 5,000. And remember, just simply the men were numbered, so a good way to do this, I know that this is a little bit of a different paradigm than the average, probably American setting. But if you're simply a dad here, just raise your hand this morning. If you're simply a dad, okay? What's that? Did I not ask it right? I don't know. Okay, if you're not a mom. So if you're a dad, just raise your. Okay, very, very good. So notice here that the percentages are very low compared to the rest of the people that are here. Here's the point. You may have had 10, 15,000 people that were there. Some say up to 20,000 people. But notice this here. And Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed to the disciples, and the disciples to them that were set down. In other scriptures, the Bible tells us that he told the disciples to organize the people in ranks of 50 and 100 first, so that the miracle could be played out with unity, and it could be done in an orderly process. I think there's much to be learned from that. I was talking with a client this week, and I was telling him about a client that I once had who was a small business owner, and he called me and he said, I have severe anger management issues. And what was interesting about it is the biggest way that I helped this young man deal with anger, you ready for it? Did we go back to his past? Sometimes that's needful. Did we get him connected with the Lord? Sometimes that's needful. But the biggest way that we helped this young man deal with his anger management issues is we got him a date planner. Honestly, we got him a date planner. Because he was trying to remember everything. And what was interesting was is it eased a lot of tension. Before Jesus passed out this amazing amount of food, he organizes the people in ranks of 50 and ranks of 100. And sometimes a lack of disorganization can be bad advertisement for your marriage, for the people in your business, because if they're organized, they're going to get along. One of the things that in our basketball program, the details that we have to look out for are unbelievable, because if one detail fails, the whole night can be shot. Teams traveling from sometimes 100, 150 miles away. You've got junior high teams, you've got boys teams, girls teams, and you have all these parents that are coming. And one little detail that you miss can cause an amazing amount of frustration. And for some of us, the issue is not that I don't get along with my spouse. The issue is not, well, our children don't get along. For some of us, we're caught up potentially in the rat race, and the disorganization is causing us to look like we're at odds with one another, but if we're in a more of an organized setting, we may be getting along a lot better. There's a lot to be said about Jesus organizing the multitudes in ranks of 50 and 100 before he feeds the masses. And could it be that the lack of organization could have inhibited the miracle, if you will? Okay? So, before God brought down the walls of Jericho, first of all, they had to march for 7 days. And sometimes we forget to march the way we need to, and it inhibits the miracle that God can do. Now, notice this here. You're going to see another passage where Jesus endures criticism. Isaiah 53 tells us he was despised and rejected of men. A man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. And we esteemed him smitten of God. People looked at him as if he was a malefactor. He was a criminal. God must be judging him. But you're going to see as we go through this, he's going to do this amazing miracle, and it's going to lead to criticism. When you're criticized, what's the first feeling that you feel? What did I do wrong? I'm sure I'm doing something to cause this. And what's amazing is the very being that was the most perfect individual to ever live, with no sin whatsoever, no guile was found in his mouth, surrounded by criticism. Now, last week we talked about Sabbath day issues. We didn't look into the specificities of the Sabbath and why we meet on the first day of the week and how Christ was a fulfillment of the Sabbath. We did not look into that. But what we talked about is how the Jews actually, in order to criticize Christ, would take the most noble of causes and get wrapped up into what we called surface logic, and they would use that as a way to criticize him. I was thinking this morning on the way to church how I've had people criticize ministry before, and there's a lot to criticize. But they've criticized maybe my wife and myself or the church, and what they'll do is they'll take the most noble of causes to grab a hold of and use that as a means to their own end. So we've had churches that when we got there were predominantly older people. Younger people would start coming, and they were very talented, and the people would become very jealous because of that. And it's a very common thing to happen. And then they bring like the most noble of causes in front of you and say something like this. Pastor, I have friends that I want to invite to church. And if those children are running around, they could hit them and those people will possibly fall and they won't want to come to church. And that's why I pastor Crossroads. But here's the point is what's interesting is that this is a common tactic of people when they have a beef against something bigger. They'll take the smallest of issues and then attach the most noble of causes to it. And what did we say last week? That they had Sabbath day issues with Christ. And this is very important if you weren't here last week. So what happens is they took the most noble of causes, and then what they did is this. They got caught up in the surface logic of it. It appeared bad. In other words, this man is taking his bed and walking on the Sabbath. It had the appearance of being bad. And if you get caught up in people's complaints, you can be sitting there going, well, that kind of does make sense. They're not supposed to work on the Sabbath, right? He is kind of moving and working, and you can get caught up in all that. But what I didn't finish out with last week is this, is one of the things that you want to remember when you're being criticized, whether by friends, family, coworkers, whoever it is, you want to be able to stop and ask yourself a set of questions. One of those questions is this. Once again, people are going to have their small issues, and what they're going to do is, and remember, there's always a bigger issue that's driving that, usually a heart issue that's driving that. And then what they're going to do is that there's going to be a surface logic there where it could appear bad. As we said last week, somebody could say, you let your kids do that, or you participate in that, and I didn't think you being a Christian would talk that way. They'll always try to have this Sabbath day issue, this thing that it appears bad, but it's not really. And there's four things I think we need to remember when we're being criticized like this. One is this. Is this person trying to help you, or are they just complaining and venting? And this is a really important thing. All throughout the Gospels, are people really trying to help Christ see something in a better way, or are they just venting their frustrations, mostly because the Pharisees were jealous of him because of the multitudes that followed him? That's number one that we have to ask ourselves. Are they trying to help us? Because people that are truly trying to help you don't go to other people and say, can you believe that they're doing that? That's not the tone and the manner that people speak in. When people are trying to help you, they come to you and say, hey, I just want you to know that, man, first of all, I've got so many problems myself. So secondly, I'm probably the least qualified to talk with you about this. But also, there's so many instances in the past where I thought I was right on this, but I was wrong. And you may, that is the tone. And that's the manner that people have when they want to help you. But this idea of this sarcastic, condescending, demeaning tone, you have to ask the question, are they trying to help me, or are they just trying to vent because they're scorners? It's very important that we ask that question. And that can help you to not allow those accusations to attach to you. Number two, are there glaring issues in their own life? I think this is very interesting. In Matthew 7, Jesus said it so well, and I know we're very familiar with this passage, but I'm going to read from Matthew 7, because Jesus said, judge not that ye be not judged. And this is unrighteous judgment, because in John 7, he says, judge not according to the appearance. Okay, so let me quote that again, because that just kind of backs up everything that we were talking about before. In John 7, Jesus said, judge not according to the appearance, but when ye judge, judge righteous judgment. So God actually tells us to be a judging people. But when you judge, judge righteous judgment. In other words, make sure that your motive is for the glory of God. Make sure that you're seeing all the facts before you jump to an emotional conclusion. Make sure that you're doing it in the right way at the right time to help someone. But he did say, judge not according to the appearance. And that's where most judgment lies. One of the things I've learned to do is that when I listen to the news, if you don't watch it, you'll be guilty of having a naughty ear. Did you know that God actually, in the book of Proverbs, holds the ear just as accountable as he does the tongue? A wicked doer giveth heed to a naughty ear. She may think, well, I'm not the one who is gossip. Hold on. A wicked doer giveth heed to a naughty ear. And I don't hear much gossip in my life, because here's what I do if I hear gossip. And I remember I was at New Testament Baptist a few years ago, and I was at somebody's house. And it's hard when you're at somebody's house and it's a really nice house and they're feeding you really good food, and then they start gossiping about the pastor or the leadership or whatever it was. Because, man, I was really enjoying that steak. And I was at his house, and I couldn't believe I had the guts to do this, because I was sitting in this guy's kitchen, and he said, well, and the pastor, and I went, what? I said, is he here? He's not here, is he? So I'm not going to talk about that. You have to be that bold, or else if you just sit there and listen, especially if you start responding. Now, one of the things you can do is just kind of sit there like this and keep changing the subject. Or you can just sit there with, everybody know, this is where we live at, right? This happens all the time. But the point is this, as I said last week, that people come up to me a lot of times in the past and past ministries and say, I guess you've heard. And I go, I haven't heard, because people don't try to gossip around me too much, because I'm not going to listen to it. Okay, but here's the point, is that a wicked doer giveth heed to a naughty tongue. The ear is just as guilty as the tongue, according to the book of Proverbs. And if you will shut a conversation down and continually do that, that person will stop coming to you to talk about things. And you'll find that person may stop hanging around you. Because some people really, the Bible says that in Proverbs 1, I think it's in verse 24, surely a scorner, he delights in his scorning. He wants to be around people that want to feast on that. Now, Matthew 7, judge not that ye be not judged. So he's talking about unrighteous judgment. For with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. So when I hear something on the news, and just because someone's famous or popular doesn't mean that biblical principles go out the door. And so when you hear something on the news about somebody, it's easy to go, oh man, I never thought. And being a person in leadership, I've learned to start going, we don't know that that's true. All we know is that they think that that's true. And in fact, there was a newspaper article not too long ago in the Calistar Banner about a friend of mine, a friend of many of yours. And I read through the whole thing. I said, this is nothing but an emotional ambushment. I said, I've been through enough of these in leadership and in organizations that this has nothing to do with the facts of the matter. It's all based on supposition. But the point is this, is that if you want people to assume the best about you until they have all the facts, you need to be willing to do that to other people. With what measure ye meet, it shall be measured unto you again. And that's a very important point. Now, he says, and why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, and considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye? So we know that the picture of somebody with a two before in their eye. And he says, why are you trying to pick out a splinter in someone else's eye if you have a big two by four in your own eye? But I want you to notice here, if you'll kind of read between the lines here, Jesus is intimating, it's an old word, he's hinting that people that have beams in their own eyes, they have this propensity to try to pluck out the splinter in other people's eyes. In almost every situation where I see people gossiping or running down someone, there's huge, glaring mistakes and problems in that person's life. Go to Matthew 23. So you have to ask the question, are they trying to help you, or are they just trying to vent? Billy Graham said years ago in his autobiography that he developed this philosophy that he would not listen to criticism unless the person criticizing could be helped by the furtherance of his organization. That's an interesting take. Let me say it again. He developed this philosophy, he wouldn't listen to criticism unless the person that was criticizing could be helped by the furtherance or the betterment of their organization. And I thought that was an interesting take, I guess because he had received so much criticism in certain areas. But in Matthew 23, look what Jesus says here. Verse number 23. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye pay tithe of mint and anise and cummin and have omitted the weightier matters of the law. They were so specific about even tithing off their herbs and making sure that a portion of that went back to spiritual things. But they've omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought ye to have done and not to leave the other undone. Ye blind guides which strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. I had a guy that tell me a few months ago, I was in conversation with him. And I actually went to college with this guy. And unfortunately, his marriage ended in divorce. And I was calling him up just to kind of talk to him about that, see if there's any way to help him at all. And he's from a background where they strain at gnats and swallow camels. In other words, they're very, very legalistic about some outward things. But here's what he said in the conversation. I thought that is just par for the course for what Jesus said. In the conversation, here's what he said. He said, I'll tell you what, I just can't take my wife wearing pants. But in the very same conversation, he said, you know, though, I did just meet a woman at church, and I was thinking about dating her, and she may be a possibility for marriage. And I'm thinking, you got to be joking me that you're not willing to reconcile with your wife because of pants versus a dress, but you're willing to go and marry someone else while your wife is still alive and the marriage is still reconcilable. Do you see how legalism can get us just totally off base? But it's interesting here how there can be these glaring issues, yet we're just focusing on the splinter in someone else's eye. Four things we need to ask. Are they trying to help us or vent us? Number two, are there glaring issues in their own life? Number three, this is great. I love this one. Have they garnered unity with those that are around them the most? This is really important because I find that unstable, unsteady people cannot get unity with those that they live with all the time, yet they're always trying to get unity and fix other people. Best example I can give of this, one time we had a men's meeting, and what was interesting was that we had made a decision about the church, and everybody was on board. Then all of a sudden, at church the next week, one of the men that was there, his wife came, and she was kind of debating me about a point that we made and a decision that we made. I thought that was interesting because her husband actually agreed with me, or the rest of the men, that is, because it wasn't about me. He agreed with the rest of the men, but then she was trying to convince me, but she didn't even have unity with her own husband yet. And my rule on that is that if you don't have unity at home, no really reason to try to be getting unity with me. Now, here's the point. Not that I'm the focus there, but here's the point is that I find that people that criticize other people, honestly, they really don't have unity with those that live with them, and they don't have unity with those that they're around the most. Yet they're still trying to convince other people to be right with them. Notice that. Watch that. And usually with those kind of people, the only time they really have unity is when they're all mad at the same person at the same time. It's very interesting to watch. It'll kind of absolve you a little bit because you can get caught up in the feeling of that, in the accusation of it. The last thing to consider is, are these people known to be critical? Is it a common thing? Do they have a rage? Do they have an anger? Do they have a desire? Do they have a love for pushing down people? Do they have a pride within them that only feels good about themselves when they're pushing other people down? And so therefore what happens is that it's not that their issue is about the issue that they're talking about, but their rage attaches itself to anything wrong with other people that are around them. Are they known for being a critical people? Let's go to Proverbs 1:22. I just want us to see this for a few moments here. Proverbs 1 and verse 22. Proverbs 1 and verse 22. I want you to see this, that I feel sorry for the person described in this passage here. How long, you simple ones, will you love simplicity? And the scorner delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge. People that love to run each other, love to run other people down, I really feel sorry for them because it shows me there's a deficiency in their lives. They're not content with the presence of Christ. And they need to have somebody to run down in their lives. Let's go back to John chapter 6 for a few moments here. John chapter 6. You're going to see that his teaching, he's going to do this incredible miracle, feed what we call the 5,000. And then you're going to see he's going to garner criticism because of this. Notice this here in verse number 12. When they were filled, he said unto his disciples, gather up the fragments that remain, that nothing be lost. I believe it is very godly to save. It's very godly to appreciate the substance that you have. Let's go. I want to prove that here. Proverbs 21:20. Let's go there real quick. Proverbs 21 and verse number 20. That when we appreciate what we have, and we're not just wasteful with what God has given us. It shows a thankfulness that everything comes from the hand of God, and the Lord gives and the Lord can take away at any time. It would appear and it would seem like that somebody that is that concerned about the food being taken up so that nothing be lost, it would look like, well, they're just carnal and they're just misers. But no, it shows that we have faith in God when we appreciate what God has given us. Proverbs 21 and verse 20. There is treasure to be desired and oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man, the Bible says, spendeth it up. Let's go to Proverbs 12 and verse 27. Proverbs 12 and verse 27. So notice that he said, first of all, there is treasure and oil in the house of the wise. Okay? So it's not wrong to have things on hand. You've heard the quote before. John Wesley said, earn all you can, give all you can, save all you can. Okay? Proverbs 12 and verse number 27. This is probably my favorite one. Proverbs 12 and verse number 27 says this. The slothful man or the lazy man roasteth not that which he took in hunting. In other words, he's not appreciative for what he has. Then he says this. But the substance of a diligent man is precious. So when I was a younger Christian, if anybody was that concerned about their house or that concerned about their substance or that concerned about their money, I often would just write them off as carnal. That kind of stuff would go through my mind. And once again, I was judging according to the appearance. And it was youthful judgment. But God tells us that the substance of a diligent man is precious to him. Not because he's selfish, but he appreciates that it comes from the hand of God and the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Now, going back, if we can, to John chapter 6, let's notice this here. So Jesus took up the fragments that nothing be lost. But notice this here as we move through this here in John chapter 6. the scripture says here in verse number 13, therefore they gathered them together and filled 12 baskets with the fragments that were... with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves which remained over the and above them which they had eaten. Then those men, when they had all seen the miracles that Jesus did, said, this is of a truth, that prophet should come into the world. Now this is interesting. You'll notice in the New Testament, this phrase here, that prophet or the prophet is used on more than one occasion. Okay, so I'm not going to ask the question, do you know why that is? Because it's not something we talk about in the New Testament church. But real quick, as I just want you to see it, let's go back to Deuteronomy 18 and verse number 15. There was a prophecy given in the Old Testament in Deuteronomy 18 of a coming prophet. And you're going to find here that the Jews were looking for that prophet. I know that we know that he was looking for the Messiah. He was looking for the Christ. We know that they were looking for the suffering servant. We know that, but... and they were looking for, obviously, other passages to be fulfilled. But they were also looking for a coming prophet. In Deuteronomy 18 and verse number 15, we're just going to breeze by this real quick. Deuteronomy 18 and verse number 15. The scripture says, the Lord thy God will raise up thee a prophet. In the King James, in the book of Deuteronomy, it's actually capitalized. Because it's believed that that is a reference to the coming Messiah. Okay? From the midst of thee, of thy brethren, like unto me, unto him ye shall hearken. Okay, so when they say back in the book of John, chapter 6 and verse number 14, then those men, when they had seen the miracle that Jesus did, said, this is of a truth, that prophet that should come into the world. Most Bible commentators believe that's a reference back to Deuteronomy 18 and verse number 15. So I just want to give you that reference there. Let's go back to John here for a few moments here, the book of John. And notice here, as we go through this here, the book of John, in verse number 15, look what the scripture says here. When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king, he departed again into the mountains himself alone. And then it says, and when even was now come, his disciples went down unto the sea. So you're going to see a prioritization by Jesus here. Now, I'm going to say it once again. I believe that we would have taken a different route here than what Jesus took. I know we would have. Okay, I'm not saying that we individually, but I think at large in the way that we handle church and handle the gospel in our day, we would have went a different route here than Jesus is about to go. Because Jesus is about to deliver a hard sermon. Now, the thought that would prevail today would be this. Well, why drive the multitudes away when we can keep them? They got to go somewhere. And if they're in our audience, then at least we could help them. But Jesus is so emphatic about why they were coming that he pushes the point and he delivers a hard sermon. But I say to you that the hardness of the sermon was not because of what Jesus said. I've always looked at John 6 and I've thought, you know, I can see why it's hard for them to receive that, but there's a sense where it's not that hard because I believe his own disciples that loved him passionately, they got it. They had no problem with it. Even though they didn't necessarily understood it, they just wanted to be with him. Now notice here, as we go through this here, it says here in verse number 17, and he entered into a ship and went over the sea toward Capernaum. And it was now dark, and Jesus was not yet come to them. And the sea arose by reason of a great wind that blew. So that when they rowed about 25 or 30 furlongs, they see Jesus walking on the sea and drawing nigh into the ship, that they were afraid. But he said to them, "It is I, be not afraid." Then they willingly received him into the ship, and immediately the ship was at the land whither they went. The day following, when the people which stood on the other side of the sea saw that there was none other boat there, save that one whereinto his disciples were entered, and that Jesus went not with the disciples into this boat, but that the disciples were gone away alone, howbeit there came other boats, it says, from Tiberias, nigh unto the place where they did eat bread after the Lord had given thanks. When the people therefore saw that Jesus was not there, neither his disciples, they also took shipping and came to Capernaum seeking for Jesus. Let's stop right there. This sounds really good. They're seeking for Jesus. Look how many people we're reaching right here. It's incredible. I mean, they got to go somewhere. Might as well keep them in our audience. Jesus is going to blow the audience out in just a few moments. And you're going to see why here. The crux of this chapter is in verse 34. Watch out what it says here. And when they had found him on the other side of the sea, they said unto him, "Rabbi, when camest thou hither?" How did you get here? Okay. Then it says, and Jesus answered and said unto them, "Verily I say unto you, ye seek me not because ye saw the miracles, but because ye did eat the loaves and were filled." So first of all, John 6 tells us they followed him because of the miracles. But then you're going to find they got on their ships. They sought out Jesus. It looks so good. They're seeking out Jesus. But notice what it says. "Ye seek me not because ye saw the miracles, but because ye did eat of the loaves and were filled." And then Jesus says this. This is a great message for us this morning. "Labor not for that meat which perisheth, but for that meat which endureth unto everlasting life, which the Son of Man shall give unto you. For him hath God the Father sealed." And you can understand the whole message that Jesus is going to teach here based upon this verse here. Look at verse 28. "Then they said unto him, What shall we do that we might work the works of God?" Now once again, why are they asking these questions? What do they want? They want the food. They want the material blessings. They see Jesus as a benevolent king who obviously can meet their physical needs. But they're not seeing Jesus as he is the Son of God. They're not seeing him in his divinity. And here's the thing. They're not wanting that. Now here's the thing. Because they don't want that, Jesus is going to push the issue until they see that they don't want that. Or honestly, until the ones that don't want that are not following him. I think this is very intriguing. Look at verse number 29. "Then Jesus answered and said, This is the work of God, that you believe on him whom he has sent. They said therefore unto him, What sign showest thou then?" Hold on a second. What sign showest thou them? He just fed the 5,000. Well, what sign? Let's stop right here. Have you ever noticed how many times Jesus is on trial in the scriptures? Did you know that God is still on trial in our day and age? And you know what's crazy about it? What's crazy about it is God's not the ones that's on trial. We are the ones who are on trial. Condemned already because we believe not in the name of the only begotten Son of God. J. Vernon McGee told the story about this young couple They were on their honeymoon, and they went to the Louvre in France, and they had to pay their 2 francs and to go all the way through it. And they got done, and they said, who would pay 2 francs to see that again? And it was a guy that was behind him that actually loved the artwork so much that he went every day and paid his 2 francs. And he said to the young people, he said, the art is not that which is on trial. He said, it is the viewer that is on trial to see if they can appreciate the art. But just because multitudes are questioning God, it's as if Jesus is on trial in our day and age. But I want you to know that no matter what kind of verdicts we come to, Jesus isn't going to change. And the only thing that can be altered is how we are blessed or how we are cursed, depending upon if we rest upon that chief cornerstone or it falls on us, according to the scriptures. But Jesus is on trial, but we are the ones that are really on trial. Jesus is constantly on trial in the Gospels. Now, I want you to see this here as you look through this here. Notice here in verse number 30, they said unto him, what sign showest thou that we may see and believe thee? What dost thou work? And here's what's interesting, though. What if Jesus here, because he's going to start preaching that you sought me only because you ate of the bread, but then he's going to start moving over and saying, I am the bread. I am that bread which came down from heaven. And they're not going to understand it at all. But here's the point that I want to make here, that what's intriguing about this is, as you look at this, what if Jesus would have just went with the people? What if Jesus would have said, okay, I got to keep the people here. They obviously want bread. They're hungry. They're afraid. The Romans are in power. They're Jews. And they're in their land, but the Romans are ruling the land. I need to keep the people. What if people would have gave them all the bread that they wanted? How would that have ended? Now, how many of you children think, well, then they would have loved him? Do you think that's the case? Nope. When God gave the children of Israel, did you know one of the greatest curses that God can give it to a society is prosperity? A society that abides in unbelief, yet God gives them unbelievable prosperity. God will show them the end of their ways. And first of all, they're a society that will end up destroying themselves. But also, let's understand that they would still end up hating Jesus. Because what does the Bible say in the book of Isaiah? That the wicked are like a wave that's tossed to and fro. And there's no peace, saith my God, to the wicked. And if you give a sinner all the wealth in the world, all the comforts in the world, he will still find something to complain about. He will still find something to be angry about because there's a rage within him that has not yet been pacified. And even when God gave the manna, guess what? The people still complained. The people still murmured. What if he would have just said, okay, I'll give you the meat. I'll give you the bread. I'll be that kind of a leader for you. And kept the people around. They still would have ended up tossing him out at some point. They would have found some reason to reject him. Now, look at this. If you see here in verse 32, he says, verily I say unto you, Moses gave you not that bread, gave you not that bread from heaven, but my Father giveth you the true bread from heaven. So you're going to see here that he's going to make the switch here. And not really so much the switch, but you're going to see him focus on who he is and why he came. Can you children quote the verse? Man shall not live by what? Bread alone, but by what? Every word of God. For the bread which God, bread of God is he which cometh down from heaven and giveth life unto the world. Look at verse number 35 here. And Jesus said unto him, I am the bread of his life. He that cometh to me shall never hunger, and he that believeth on me shall never thirst. Now, once again, look at verse 34, though, because I skipped that. Then they said unto him, so look at, they answer him and say, Lord, evermore, give us this bread. So he says in the previous verse, for the bread of God is he which cometh down from heaven and giveth life unto the world. Then said they unto him, Lord, evermore, give us this bread. So here's what you can see. You can see you're going to see a clash here, a clash of expectations. They say, Lord, give us this bread. And Jesus is sitting there and he says this, because they're wanting him to produce more bread, more food. And Jesus says, I'm it. And they're sitting there seeing this man from Galilee who may have been more plain looking than we realize. A man who could not come in a chariot, but rather on a donkey. And they're going to say, what are you talking about? And you're going to see here a clash of expectations here. Now, I want you to notice here, once again, verse number 36. But I said unto you that ye also have seen me and believe not. And all that the Father hath given me shall come to me, and him that cometh to me I will in no wise cast out. For I came down from heaven not to do mine own will, but the will of him that sent me. And this is the Father's will which hath sent me, that all which he hath given me I should lose nothing, but I should raise it up again at the last day. Thank God for that. That all that the Father hath given me, I should lose nothing, and I will raise them again the last day. And this is the will of him that sent me, that everyone which seeth the Son and believeth on him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up the last day. Look at verse 41. Then the Jews, you're going to see a clash of expectations. They murmured at him because he said, I am the bread which came down from heaven. And they said, is not this Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How is it then that he saith, I came down from heaven? Now notice once again, their familiarity with his background, their familiarity with the region he was from, is going to keep them from a great blessing here. It was such a great lesson here. Could it be that the greatest blessings in your life you already have right around you? And if we don't watch, let's go to Acts chapter 17. We could end up much like the people in the book of Acts chapter 17 when Paul stands up on Mars Hill. And I want you to see in Acts chapter 17, in verse number 16. Now, while Paul waited for them at Athens, his spirit was stirred in him because he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. Therefore, he disputed he in the synagogue with the Jews. Look at verse 18. Then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics encountered him, and some said, what will this babbler say? Others some, he seemeth to be a setter forth of strange gods, because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him unto Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new doctrine whereof thou speakest is? For thou bringest certain strange things to our ears. We would know, therefore, what these things mean. For all the Athenians and the strangers which were there spent their time in looking else, spent their time in nothing else, but either to tell or hear, notice what it says, some new thing. Do you know what's the saddest thing about our society today? Is we have so much of everything at our fingertips, and you know what everyone's still kind of looking for? Let's scan through Facebook. Let's see some new video, see something viral. Let's see some new thing. I'm going to tell you, the greatest curse to an unbelieving society is giving them everything that they want, because that's what we're seeing in our day and age. Because even after we have everything at our fingertips, we're still, of all men, extremely miserable. And notice here, Jesus says, I am that bread that came down from heaven. But because of their familiarity with his background, with his family, where he's from, they're going to say, this can't be, you can't be from heaven whatsoever. But the point is that because of their familiarity, could it be that the greatest blessings that we have in life are already in our lives? And rather than looking for some new thing, some new something. So I used to live in Johnstown, as you've heard too many times, and Johnstown was a very poor, decrepit place in a lot of ways. And young people would move out. They'd go to college and move away. But what was interesting is they would end up moving back home. Do you know around the age? It was around the age of 28, 29, 30, 31. And it's almost as if they would grow up thinking, man, I got to get out of this place. I got to get out of here. And I hear some of you call Ocala Slocala. You should live in some of the towns that your parents are from. But what's interesting is this, is that those children would end up usually coming back after they would see, well, I thought life would be better in the big city. I thought life would be better living somewhere else. And as they started to see what really counted in life, you'd see a lot of those same families coming back around the age of 28, 29, 30, 31, and realizing, you know what? Home wasn't as bad as we thought it was. I say this morning because I think that because of so many new things coming at us, we are in our spirits, like the Athenians, looking for some new thing all the time. And could it be that the greatest blessings of life, the greatest, they're looking for more bread, and Jesus says, I am the bread. You're going to see that the apostles stick with him throughout this chapter because they appreciate, listen now, the personhood of Christ. And unless we learn to love that being of who he is, you're going to always be looking at after some new thing. And he's just become, the external surroundings of church and Bible are just going to become all too familiar to you. Let's go to the book of John for a few moments here. We're going to close with this in the book of John. Notice as he goes through this here, they're going to miss him because of their familiarity with him. They want something more than his being. And you're going to see that Jesus is going to push the point, and here's the crux of the sermon. He says, I'm the bread, are you happy with me? I'm the bread, are you happy with me? Are you happy with just me? And once again, Jesus could have went so many ways from this point. Jesus could have said, I'll keep giving you the bread. I'll keep giving you the bread. You need to keep the people, at least they're around me. At least they're going to hear a good message. I'll keep giving you the bread. Look what he says. No man can come to me except the Father which hath sent me draw him. Verse number 43. And I will raise him up the last day. Verse number 45 that is. It is written in the prophets, and they shall be taught of God. Every man therefore that hath heard and that hath learned of the Father cometh to me. I think this is interesting. Jesus is saying that he had such a divine presence that the true believers, true seekers would, listen now, they would get it. Do you think that the disciples understood everything Christ said? Of course not. It's possible they had just as many misunderstandings about what Christ said as these people that are about to leave him. It's extremely possible. But I've noticed this characteristic in seekers. There's a lot that we don't understand, but we just want him. There's a lot that we don't get, but we just want to be around Jesus. It's entirely possible that they misunderstood more than what these other people misunderstood. But his being wasn't enough. Give us the bread, give us food, give us material blessings. And when at the end of this chapter, when the disciples depart from him, and Jesus turns to them because he was not an insecure leader, he had no one to impress but the Father, and says, will you go away also? Jesus doesn't say, Peter doesn't answer him and say, well, why would we do that? Because by following you, we get this, we get that, and we know you have wisdom. All he says is, where else are we going to go? In other words, these people, seekers, just appreciate the demeanor, the being of Jesus. That's why when you talk to a skeptic, to get all worried about their arguments is kind of crazy. And just say, well, man, there's a lot I don't understand either. And someone will talk about hell. They'll talk about, you know, if God's so loving, why would he allow all the sufferings in the world? And just agree with them, say, I don't get it either. But Jesus said, come unto me, all ye that labor and heavy laden, I will give you rest. And he's given me rest. And just keep saying that. And keep exhibiting that satisfaction that you have in Jesus. Notice here, just a few more verses here and we'll close here. Notice this. As Jesus goes through this, look in verse number 47. Verily I am saying to you that he that believeth on me hath everlasting life. And then he says again, I am that bread of life. Now remember, to understand his sermon, it's not difficult what he's saying. What's difficult is there's a clash of expectations. They don't want just him. He is not enough for them. And if his being is not enough for you, then heaven will not be enjoyed by you either. Notice what he says. I am that bread of life. Your fathers did eat manna in the wilderness and are dead. Look what he says. If I give you bread, you're still going to be dead. What's the point? I'm telling you that if this was an average church growth speaker, he'd be saying, man, we got to manufacture more bread here. At least they're coming to us. At least they'll be around us. At least we can give them a good message. But if you're not making the person of Christ the delineation point and the main attractant, why are we attracting him? Look what he says. I am that living bread which came down from heaven. If any man eat of this bread, he shall live forever. And the bread that I will give is my flesh. So he keeps honing down, hammering down the point. The hardness, though, is not in the message. It's in their expectation. Because he knows that what they want is the food. He says, I'm it. And if that's not enough, you're going to miss heaven. Here's the irony of it. Look at all the material blessings that we'll have in heaven anyway. Look at all the material blessings that could be there for those that follow him anyway. He told Peter that those that follow me, they'll have houses, brethren, and lands. And so he said, but seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. But if we're not first happy with his being and just him as a person and him as being God, we're going to miss him. I am that living bread which came down from heaven. If any man eat of this bread, he shall live forever. And the bread that I will give is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world. The Jews, therefore, strove amongst themselves, said, how can this man give us his flesh to eat? So they just couldn't see the spiritual. And then Jesus said to them, verily, verily, I say unto you, except ye shall eat of the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, ye have no life in you. Whoso eateth my flesh and drinketh my blood hath eternal life, and I will raise him up the last day. For my flesh is meat indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. He that eateth my flesh and drinketh my blood dwelleth in me, and I in him. As the living Father has sent me, and I live by the Father, so he that eateth me, even he shall live by me. And how do you eat of that flesh and drink of that blood? Obviously, when we observe the Lord's Supper, you have the bread which represents the broken body of Christ. You have the blood which represents the wine or the juice that represents the blood that was shed. And when we believe on Christ, we are benefiting from that broken body. When we believe on Christ, we're benefiting from that blood that was shed at the cross. He that eateth my flesh and drinketh my blood dwelleth in me, and I in him. Verse 57. As the living Father has sent me, and I live by the Father, so he that eateth me, even he shall live by me. This is that bread which came down from heaven. Not as your fathers did eat manna and are dead, but that eateth of his bread shall live forever. These things said he in the synagogue as he taught in Capernaum. Now you're going to see an awkward situation come about. Does anybody know what it feels like to feel awkwardness in a room? You know, that's like somebody says something that either could be risque or edgy, or if somebody says something that hits home, and then you can feel there's kind of an awkwardness in the room. You can see here that the disciples are having to process all this. Jesus is at conflict with this multitude, with the religious leaders of the day. Many, therefore, of his disciples, when they had heard this, said, this is a hard saying. Who can hear it? What was hard about it? Let's just stop right there. What was difficult about it? You ever have somebody that you're explaining the most simple of things to, and you're saying, I just don't get it. I don't understand it. Do you see what the block was? What was the block? The message here wasn't difficult. What was the block? The block was this. They wanted something more than what Jesus was offering. We see this in marriage counseling where people really inside don't want to just enjoy a happy marriage. And they've got their mind on something else or someone else, and we cannot turn them. And they'll try to act like we're the problem in counseling. Well, I just don't understand it. Well, I just don't agree with that. And you see the same thing here. Accusing Jesus, but the real block was on their hearts because they wanted more than what he was offering. I think that's important when you're even dealing with accusations. Look what he says here. Doth this offend you? So when Jesus knew in himself that his disciples murmured at it, he said unto him, Doth this offend you? What if you shall see the Son of Man ascend up where he was before? It is the Spirit that quickeneth, the flesh profiteth nothing. You know, Jesus said, I'm here to feed your spirit. I'm here for spiritual things, because the kingdom of God cometh not with observation. It is within us. The words that I speak unto you, they are spirit and they are life. Let's just stop right here. This is why I enjoy a home group Bible study more than Sunday morning. There's a little bit of an expectation to preach a big sermon on Sunday morning. You know what I love about Wednesday night home groups or any kind of home groups is we get the Bible and we just read it. There's no pressure for a big sermon. Here's what I love about it. We're just sitting here and there's people coming together and just happy the Bible's being read and explained. And when you have a group, I think Jesus is greatly honored when people are just happy with people that appreciate the spirit of what he's saying. They're not looking for bread. They're not looking for life enhancement. They're saying, Jesus, we get it. You're the bread. There's a lot we don't understand. There's a lot, Jesus, that we don't get. In fact, by following you, it seems like we get more skepticism than anything from other people. It seems like now we become on trial with you. But we just want you. Jesus is looking for people that just appreciate that he is the bread that's coming. You want to feast off of him. I think the disciples didn't, it's not that they understood, it's not that they misunderstood as much as the skeptics. I think they misunderstood probably more. But they were just happy that he was there. There was something about him. And if you look at this, let's follow this down here. It's a great sermon here. Let's follow this down here. Notice Jesus keeps pushing the point. Finney said, pastors should not just be preaching sermons. They should be turning a point over and over and over and over and over again until either people receive it or they're driven away. Look what he says. Anybody remember what verse we're on here? 63. Okay, 64. But there are some of you that believe not, for Jesus knew from the beginning who they were that believed not and who should betray him. He said, therefore I say unto you that no man can come unto me except it were given unto him by my Father. Isn't that great? It kind of, and we have to believe, we have to receive, but it kind of takes the pressure off us of working out all the mechanisms of the heart. Because, you know, like MacArthur says, it is hard sometimes to believe. This idea that believing is easy, no, it's not. It's not. There are times where it is hard to believe because we have different mechanisms of the heart. We try to apply our own wisdom. And there's a grace that we need. We need the Father to draw. And sometimes God allows your own mechanisms of the heart. When you're, once again, you have to look at John Bunyan for those 2 years that he spent doubting his salvation. I believe the story is in Grace Abounding. And the struggle of Martin Luther to figure out what does faith mean? What does grace mean? You know, what is acceptable to God? I went through an amazing struggle in Bible college. And when you believe in hell and you don't know that you're going to heaven, that's an amazing struggle, right? That's an unbelievable struggle that goes on. But at some point, God allows us to allow the mechanisms of the heart to play out to the point where we just kind of put our hands down and all of our attempts to try to climb into heaven, all of our attempts to try to figure out God, they come to naught, and then God gives us a grace to believe. Look what he says here. Therefore, I said unto you, verse 65, no man can come unto me except it were given unto him of the Father. From that time, many of his disciples went back and walked no more with him. Now, when it says his disciples, this may have been disciples in appearance. Because notice what the verse says in verse 64. For Jesus knew from the beginning who they were that believed not, and who should betray him. Look at verse 67. Then said Jesus unto the 12, will ye go also away? I preached this sermon December 31st, 1999, at 11:30 p.m. I was at church, and my wife was at home. And I thought, I'm going to be preaching, and Y2K is going to happen. Anybody remember Y2K? Anybody remember that? And I preached out of this verse here. And Simon has the response of responses. Simon may have said a lot of things wrong, but he says one thing right. Then Simon Peter answered and said, Lord, to whom shall we go? Thou hast the words of life. You think great believers understand everything? There's so much we don't understand. I don't understand how to explain that a child grows up in an abusive home, but God is still good. I don't know how to explain that, correct? I don't understand how there's children that are good, clean, honoring children, and they die young, and then a reprobate sinner who could care less about God lives to be 100. I don't understand that. There's so much that I don't understand, but all I know is where else am I going to go? I love him as a being, and I'm not going to get entrapped in the maze of understanding. I love him, his demeanor, the spirit that comes with him, and I just want to be around a word that puts me into that place, honestly. And the word of God connects me with who he is. And we believe and are sure, Peter says, that thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus answered and said, have not I chosen you 12, and one of you is a devil? He spake of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, for is he that should betray him, being one of the 12. I want to accentuate a couple things of the sermon, of the message. Number one, Jesus was always on trial, the master at dealing with criticism. And the four things I gave you are just to start the process for you. Is this person trying to help you, or are they venting? Are they a known scorner? In other words, was the gun loaded and the trigger cocked a long time before you came on the scene? Do they have glaring issues in their own life? Big beams in their own lives, yet they're trying to fix motes in your life. The biggest one is, have they garnered unity with those that are around them? Because people that are scorners don't have unity with those that they're around the most. Yet they're always trying to get unity with other people. It's the craziest thing in the world. And really, I think there's a deeper issue. It's not that they're trying to get unity. They're actually, most of the time, looking for someone that's strong enough to meet them head on. Not always, because if you rebuke a scorner, he'll hate you. But there are some that are looking for some to meet him head on and say, why are you talking that way? Why are you doing that? You'd be amazed how most people would love you if you're truthful with them. That's why God says open rebuke is better than secret love. He that rebuketh his friend shall find more favor afterwards, Proverbs says, than he that flatters with his tongues. Jesus was not a flatterer. Be one who speaks up. Say, well, why are you talking like that? That's not the kind of conversation we have. And I have no problem doing it with people because I can't stand the ravaging effects of gossip. Because it's so untrue. That's what gets me. Listen, when you repeat something and you add tone, if you repeat something and you add tone to it, that's a negative tone. You have gossiped with your tone. Can you believe what they did? Well, you just already infused the conversation with an amazing amount of negativity. But you can gossip with your tone even if the facts are correct. I don't even like the word gossip because is that word in the Bible? Murmurers, complainers is. I don't think, is the word gossip there? King James, is it in the King James? And we look at other translations too, but I don't think, we'll study it out. Okay, everyone's on their phone right now. But you can gossip with your tone. I'm not telling you to be a mindless robot, I mean, there's things that happen that are interesting, like, heck, I can't, this is interesting that that occurred, and I don't, you know, I'm trying to learn from this, but how to deal with criticism. Jesus would not accept people mindlessly moving around him. He would not accept it. And so he asked the question to Philip, when shall we buy bread? Testing him, to prove him. He would not accept it. If you're going to reach people, you cannot accept people mindlessly moving around. Think about it. Every great person that affects people is always saying something that people are not expecting them to say, because they're not going to accept people mindlessly moving around them. You ever had an incredible wise boss or some incredible business owner that you greatly respect? They're going to say things to you that you're like, why are they even thinking about that? Because they're not going to accept people mindlessly moving around them. Could it be that we have to learn to condition our hearts to enjoy the unbelievable blessings that are around us right now? Their familiarity with Jesus. He's got to have more for us. There's got to be more than this. Once again, he says, I'm the bread of life. That's the whole focus, hopefully, of this church. It's only Jesus. That's it. It's the Word. If we're not happy with that, what are we going to be happy with? You can organize the social events of your children on your own time. Honestly, the church is, where did the church ever become responsible for that? I've heard old people tell me, well, when I pick out a church, I look at to see if they've got a good seniors bus. If they do, that's the one I go to. And you know what they are? They're in the John chapter 6 multitude. But the biggest thing, there's a reason why the average, I was coaching a young married man this last week. He's in his 30s. And a lot of men just don't realize how good of a wife they have in their 20s, and they take her for granted. And it's the familiarity of that, like we're talking about. Why do those people that leave when they're 20, they end up coming back to their hometown around 29, 30, 31, 32? Why is that? They realize that they were just looking for some new thing, but great blessings were already around them. And so there's a great skill in conditioning our hearts to appreciate what we have right around us.